It's Friday, November 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, a key White House aide testifies in the Trump impeachment inquiry.
We have not heard a single witness yet come in and provide testimony that would suggest this was anything other than defense dollars for dirt.
Also, Turkey's president says the U.S. and Russia have failed to clear Kurds out of northeastern Syria. Can a fragile deal in Yemen hold? The U.S. and China talk trade and technology. And did you ever wonder what books Leonardo da Vinci read? That's all on today's International Edition. A top State Department official testified Thursday that President Donald Trump wanted Ukraine's president to stand at a microphone and say three words: investigations, Biden, and Clinton. Democrats looking into whether Trump should be impeached released a transcript of last month's testimony by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent. Kent was quoted as saying that was the message. President Zelensky needed to go to a microphone and basically say there needed to be three words in the message, and that was the shorthand. Meanwhile, a key aide to Vice President Mike Pence, who was on the July 25th phone call between President Trump and President Volodymyr Zelensky, Jennifer Williams, was also testifying on Capitol Hill. Our correspondent from the Capitol, Catherine Gibson, is with us. Catherine, first of all, thanks for being here.
You're so welcome.
Jennifer Williams was actually on the phone call in July where President Trump allegedly asked for a favor from Ukraine's president in exchange for several hundred million dollars in military aid being released. What is Ms. Williams saying, and why is she important?
She's important because she's another one of the people who was actually on that phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president, and that helps address some of the Republican concerns about secondhand reports, about some of their criticisms, that the whistleblower who initially started all of this with his complaint were just getting their information second or third hand. Here, we're hearing directly from someone who listened in on that phone call.
And she also accompanied her boss, Vice President Pence, to a meeting with Ukraine's president in Warsaw on September 1st, where the military aid was also discussed, did she not?
That's correct. And she'll be able to address some of the broader concerns beyond that phone call about how the administration was handling U.S. foreign policy with Ukraine.
And she's one of the last witnesses to testify behind closed doors, as they say, because next week it's
next
all
week,
out in public.
Impeachment goes public. We are going to have public hearings that House Democrats hope will help make the case with the American public that President Trump should be impeached.
Now, switching gears here a little bit, the president is denying a report that was in the Washington Post and the New York Times newspapers that he asked Attorney General William Barr to hold a press conference that said he had done nothing wrong on this phone call, and apparently Attorney General Barr declined.
Right. So apparently what he wanted Attorney General Barr to do was to come out and support what President Trump has been saying all along, is that this call with the Ukrainian president is a perfect phone call, a, quote, beautiful phone call. Reportedly, the attorney general did not do that. Then the president took to Twitter to lash out and call the Washington Post his favorite term, fake news, and say that their reporting was faulty.
And the Justice Department, we should say, had issued a statement saying that this phone call did not break any campaign finance laws, and therefore no further action was warranted. So once it starts going public, I believe it's next Wednesday, what should people be watching for? This is, sometimes these things can get really, really, really deep in the weeds. What should be the takeaways, or what should people be looking for to try to get answers in these hearings?
I think that House Democrats learned a lot from the Mueller hearing earlier this summer, where they were hoping for that blockbuster TV moment that anybody in the United States would be able to take away and just instantly remember. Something that if you're not sitting in front of your TV for 3 or 4 hours that these hearings take, you would know instantly what it was all about. That didn't happen with the Mueller hearing. House Democrats have to make that happen here with the phone call, And that could be a tough proposition because you're talking about really complicated U.S. foreign aid, congressionally approved aid, how that foreign policy was being enacted, a lot of moving pieces with diplomats moving in and out of the story. It's going to be really tough to get that made-for-TV moment, but Democrats have to do it.
All right, that is VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. You can find more of her reporting on the whole impeachment inquiry on our website, voanews.com. Among the top stories in the world, Pence aide testifies at Trump impeachment inquiry. South Sudan rival leaders delay new government by 100 days. Sudan coalition wants Bashir turned over to ICC. U.S. Saudis recruited Twitter workers to spy on critics. Secret Service report, most school shootings are preventable. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is accusing Moscow and Washington of reneging on commitments to enforce the withdrawal of a Syrian Kurdish militia from Turkey's border, and he is warning of a resumption of military operations in Syria. At a news conference with Hungary's Prime Minister Thursday, Erdogan said attacks on Turkish forces came despite two separate truces that were brokered by Russia and the United States last month, which halted Turkey's military offensive.
Fakat ne Amerika 120 saatlik sürede.
He said neither the United States have been able to remove these terrorists from the area within 120 hours, nor Russia have been able to do it in 150 hours. And of course, right now, due to these elements still being present, battles against IS, the YPG, the PYD, and the PKK continue with resolve. The Turkish president said at least 11 Syrian opposition fighters were killed in an attack Thursday, but he didn't specify where or how that attack had occurred. My colleague Steve Miller spoke with VOA's Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch about the situation on the ground in northeastern Syria.
So, Heather, what can you tell us about the situation on the ground in Syria since President Erdogan is saying that the United States isn't doing enough to uphold its end of the bargain to keep what it calls, you know, Kurdish YPG fighters and terrorists out of the so-called safe zone?
The YPG fighters have, for the most part, withdrawn from the area that they said they would, which is 30 kilometers from the border in most places. That doesn't include Kamishli, which is one major urban area that is right on the border, but that wasn't part of the agreements between Russia and Turkey. There are other parts of the border that the YPG or the SDF maybe has not fully withdrawn from because they are still controlling the areas that are with their border from with Iraq. The U.S. has been criticized by Turkey for not doing enough to make sure this happens. But at the same time, this comes right on the heels of the U.S. not physically actually withdrawing all their troops from Syria, but saying they were. So they also lost a lot of their ability to dictate what happens on the ground in those border towns, as they did actually physically leave the bases on a lot of the border towns as well.
Right, because they left and they've since been, you know, repositioned to guard the oil fields, according to the Pentagon. I wanted to also ask you, there have been some reports of skirmishes in the area since the ceasefires between the United States and Russia were brokered. What is the current situation in terms of fighting?
There is sporadic fighting on the ground between the Syrian National Army, formerly known as the Free Syrian Army, which is basically a rebel group from Syria that is now acting as a proxy for Turkey. So it's a Turkish-backed militant group that is now fighting with the Kurds and also a bit with the Syrian government, which has now joined the Kurds in terms of policing their borders. So some fighting is going on. There's been some battles. Some people continue to be killed, injured, and displaced. There's a lot of fear among the local people in northeastern Syria of the Syrian National Army. As much as Turkey calls the YPG a terrorist group, likens them to ISIS, says they have values as Islamic State militants do. Local people in northeastern Syria, Kurds, believe this militant group, the Syrian National Army, is the same. And the stories that go around, some may be true, some may be not true, but they're everywhere. You'll hear stories of human rights violations and war crimes being committed. So the people themselves are terrified to go into areas that are occupied by Turkish-backed militants.
Speaking of people on the ground, when the fighting was initially taking place about a month ago, there was a lot of concern about humanitarian aid getting to those who needed it most. What actually happened? What did you see when you were there?
What started about a month ago has continued to unfold, and I think it's pretty much safe to say it is a Syria's latest humanitarian crisis. So far, about 300,000 people have fled their homes. And at the very beginning of the crisis, the international aid community evacuated the region. So there's an increasing amount of people day by day needing humanitarian aid. There's almost no aid workers or delivery systems left to bring in more aid. And winter is coming, and winter in Syria, for people that don't have homes and are living in tents, is very harsh. So, so far, there's been no sign that this crisis is going to get any better or any help is on its way.
That's Heather Murdoch. She's VOA's Middle East Bureau Chief, and she spoke with VOA's Steve Miller. Yemen's President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi met the head of the Southern Transitional Council on Thursday. In their first meeting since his Saudi-backed government and the separatists signed a power-sharing deal in the south that is intended to end months of infighting. UAE-backed separatists seeking independence for South Yemen, which was a separate country before unification in 1990, formed an uneasy alliance with President Hadi 4 years ago to stop the Houthis from capturing Aden. VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Stephen Sesh, a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, about how such agreement could help end the war, that is, in Yemen.
Mohammed, we certainly hope that will be the case, but there are a number of hurdles that lie ahead that will need to be carefully considered and surmounted in order for success to be met. I think principal, perhaps among these, is the lack of detail, if you will, on some of the implementing measures that are going to be required. There are very, very short timelines for very major steps that would need to be taken by some of the parties. That's going to pressure them all to move quickly, and they're going to meet some resistance, I think, in that regard. And there's a lot of vague requirements that will need to be ironed out in the course of implementation that will need a lot of goodwill and a lot of good faith, and that may be in short supply. So it's going to be incumbent upon the parties now to act in a way that I think reflects the spirit of yesterday's agreement, which I think has been quite positive in terms of what it suggests may be possible going forward.
The deal calls for the formation of a new cabinet within 30 days that would have equal representations for both the northerners and the southerners. The Southern Transitional Council would also join any political talks to end the war. Could that convince the Southern Transitional Council to abandon its tendency to separate?
It's not clear to me yet that this will be the final outcome, but I do think that this is an effort to bring the Southern Transition Council and its members, and even those who perhaps would look favorably on some kind of a secession, more closely into the political processes of Yemen itself, and in that effort, perhaps convince them that they have a role to play in Yemen and are encouraged to make the contributions towards Yemen's well-being and its future that will also impact favorably their interests in the south. So, yeah, it's going to be a challenge, but I do think there's an effort being made here to try to bring the Southern Transition Council more fully into Yemeni political life.
The United Nations envoy Martin Griffith, who is trying to restart talks to end the war, said the deal was an important step in peace efforts. How would that help while there is a stalemate in his efforts with the Houthis?
Well, it'll help because I do think that it creates a certain momentum to build upon now. And we'll have to stand by and see. This is the challenge. Can the Saudis, can President Hadi, can all the parties move more briskly towards enlarging a political process? And at the moment, this is only between the Hadi government and the South. But now the Saudis have full authority to oversee this agreement. They may also be able to look to the Houthis And you know, there are reports, as you know, that there are now back-channel talks between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis. So will this enable the Saudis to look more carefully at engaging more fully with the Houthis and making offers that the Houthis might find appealing to their interests as well? So I hope this can be built upon in regards to the Houthis, and we'll have to wait and see.
So what could make a settlement possible in Yemen?
A lot of it now is going to be goodwill. Honestly, Mohammed, I think that the parties have to understand this is an opportunity that has been presented to them. There's been a lot of good work put into this particular deal, but it is a narrow slice of the pie, and it needs to be enlarged, and that's going to require all the parties to see this as the way out. And they all have said they're looking for a way out that's not military in nature, that the political process is the best way to solve the war in Yemen and the conflict. And I think this demonstrates that there is an option there. I hope they can all seize it. I hope they can sit down and work hard to expand the basis that this talk provides for them and use this as a way forward to a larger agreement that may stop the conflict.
That's Stephen Sesh. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. China's Commerce Ministry said Thursday that Beijing and the United States have agreed to roll back some of the tariffs each side imposed on the other's goods during their ongoing trade dispute. Ministry spokesman Gao Feng said at a news briefing, if negotiators reach a phase one agreement in trade talks, then both the United States and China should reduce the tariffs by the same amount and at the same time. The overall size of those reductions, Gao said, would be determined as part of the negotiations. Alan Deardorff is a professor of international economics at the University of Michigan. He told VOA's Ira Melman that Thursday's news is a step in the right direction.
From what I read, they are making some progress in their negotiations, and it sounds like they want us to think, and I hope they're right, that they're going to come to an agreement to reduce some tariffs, as well as doing the things they've been saying for a couple of weeks, getting China to buy more of our agricultural products and our promising not to raise tariffs any further. That was disappointing that that's all they talked about a couple of weeks ago. That they're now talking about lowering some tariffs is a good sign, and I hope it will happen. I'm not confident that it will because, gosh, now how long has it been? These negotiations have been going on and off and off and on for quite some time, and they thought they were getting close to a deal a long time ago, and then it all fell apart.
Yeah.
When each side claimed the other backed out. And I suppose that could easily happen again. Whether the Chinese are willing to give up on some of the intellectual property issues, I think they will probably claim they already are behaving fine. But maybe they will persuade us that there will be some way of monitoring what they do and change their behavior or enforce it, prove that they're behaving well. And we might be satisfied with that.
How big of a problem is this posing, this U.S.-China trade? If you're not going to call it a war, what are you going to call it?
I certainly would say it's a trade war. I've been saying that for a long time, and so have most others. Why exactly they would say it's not a trade war, I don't know. That just seems silly. A trade war is pretty much, in my view, defined as countries raising tariffs against each other's imports and responding to the others putting up tariffs by putting up their own tariffs and just going back and forth. And that's exactly what we've been doing. I think it's a trade war. And I do think it's a big problem. It is, of course, interfering with trade between the U.S. and China, but it's having all sorts of adverse spillover effects across the world. They're not all adverse. There are some places to benefit from this, markets that can sell to us because we're not buying from China or sell to China because they're not buying from us. But for the most part, it's been harmful in so many different ways. It would be wonderful if this whole thing could get resolved. And I think what's talked about here, this phase one agreement, it's not going to end it by any means. There's no way they're going to simply get rid of all the tariffs that both have put on. But if they could make some progress in reducing them, and that might encourage them to continue negotiating further, yeah, that would be good.
Alan Deardorff is a professor of international economics at the University of Michigan. He was speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Meanwhile, authorities have charged a U.S. company with illegally selling Chinese-made security and surveillance equipment to the American military and other high-profile customers. Federal prosecutors said at a news conference Thursday that some of the equipment sold by Aventura Technologies ended up at Army bases and even on an aircraft carrier. Richard P. Donahue is the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York.
Early this morning, the court here in the Eastern District of New York unsealed a federal criminal complaint charging Aventura Technologies and seven of its current and former employees, including its entire senior management, with selling sensitive security equipment, such as networked surveillance cameras, to both government and private customers by falsely claiming that Aventura was manufacturing its equipment in Commack, New York.
Donahue said that Aventura bought equipment from China and then changed the labels to make it look like it was made in the United States.
So you're not just talking about a standalone camera that was manufactured in China. You're talking about surveillance systems and other electronic equipment that you put in your installation and you use in your installation to take note of what is going on and to record what is going on. So obviously when you have Chinese-made cameras with PRC software loaded into them, networked into sensitive installations such as Army bases, Navy bases, DOE facilities, and even American aircraft carriers, that causes a grave concern for our national security.
Donahue said there were no allegations or charges against the Chinese government. However, he added it is of grave concern to the United States that infrastructure is compromised by hardware and software made in the People's Republic of China. Coming up, some folks are turning manure into energy, and an exhibit highlights books that might have influenced Leonardo da Vinci. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at The Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, did you ever wonder what kind of books a genius might have studied? But first, organizers of a major horse jumping exhibition in Helsinki, Finland, are redefining the term horsepower. They're taking more than 100 tons of waste from hundreds of horses and converting it to electricity. The renewable energy project has grown at the annual event over the years, and it now meets all the exhibition's power needs, with some left over to heat nearby homes. VOA's Jim Randall narrates our story.
Organizers of the FEI World Cup Jumping Show in Helsinki are converting horse manure from its equine athletes into electricity to run the event and heat homes in the Finnish capital. The International Equestrian Federation is showing how sporting events can support sustainability.
We had a vision to do something for making a cleaner world, and we didn't have a clue how to start. But then we jumped into a sponsorship and partnership with Fortum, big international energy company, and they came up with this manure invention.
Horse manure power helped heat the Helsinki International Horse Show in 2017. The project grew, and the next year 235 horses produced 112 tons of manure, which fueled 168 megawatts of electricity. That's all the electricity needed at the four-day event, with a little left over for heating 26 small flats in Helsinki for a month.
Something else does need to be done, because with all the oil and the gas pollution, it's really not good. So it's really cool that from horses we can actually get electricity.
The main manure to electricity power plant for the show is Fortum Yarvenpa. It provides heat for 1,250 customers in the area. During the event, Fortum Horsepower delivered wood-based bedding for more than 200 horses staying in temporary stalls. The manure bedding mixture is then hauled to the power plant, where it's utilized in electricity production. An estimated 135 tons of manure bedding mixture will be created during this year's event. Jim Randall, VOA News.
What do you think of when someone mentions the name Leonardo da Vinci? Perhaps you think of the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper. Or maybe you think of the Vitruvian Man staring out at you from his squared circle. But did you ever think that Leonardo had to learn from others? Well, an exhibit in Milan highlights several books and other items that the curators believe very likely influenced the Renaissance genius. The books are part of the rich collection of the Library of the Franciscan Custody of the Holy Land in Jerusalem. Some 30 books are available for public viewing as part of a project called Books of Peace, a collaboration between Associated Pro Terra Sancta, a non-governmental organization of the custody of the Holy Land, and European Research Center for Books, Publishing, and Libraries. They depict antique maps, detailed drawings of plants and animals, medical and architectural achievements. Alessandra Ristagno, a student of modern philology at Università Cattolica in Milan, and a participant in the project, says the exhibition is divided into five sections.
The first one is about geography, the second one is about plants and animals, and the third one, maybe the most important one, is about the body. And the fourth one is about the arts and proportion, and the last one is about Luca Pacioli, the Dominican friar, a friend of Leonardo da Vinci, who helped him become the genius he's renowned to be.
Eduardo Barbieri, the lecturer at the Università Cattolica di Sacro Cuore in Milan and the director of the project, says the exhibition focuses more on Da Vinci the scientist than the painter.
Leonardo non ha lasciato nulla a Gerusalemme e nulla.
But we wanted to collect a series of volumes that could somehow tell Leonardo's intellectual journey, not Leonardo as a painter, but as a scientist. And we followed the big themes of geographical discovery, natural discovery, the discovery of the human body, and medicine. This is interesting because the pharmacological know-how of the Franciscan order allowed for the preservation of many medical books that were actually used for healing of the people here, and finally, the discovery of mathematics and architecture.
The books show elaborate works of creation that have been preserved for centuries, helping save knowledge of humankind from the Middle Ages into the Renaissance and to our time. Gabriele Russotti is a student and a project participant.
A lot of people are impressed from the fact that there is a link between Middle Ages or Renaissance and today's, nowadays, because we think that 500 years ago was a lot of time, but instead it looks like they already know what we know today. So I think that this is the most important, the most funny thing that I see from the people.
This year marks the 500th anniversary of the death of Leonardo da Vinci. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Tony Pollack. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your weekend.